There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to equity analyst and stock markets commentator Paul Scott to discuss all things small cap. And I can see you're looking very festive there with a nice big Christmas tree in the background, Paul.
I know we'll be singing Slade and Mariah Carey any minute now, so I thought I'd get the Christmas tree up.
Yeah, well, it's been absolutely brass monkey up here in Birmingham overnight. We've had a touch of sleet and snow as well, so it's nice to get a bit of a festive spirit. But just putting that aside, I know you've been down to the Mello Investor Conference over the past couple of days, and we've had a bit of a shaky markets of late, plus we've got the budget next week. What was the sort of the sentiment and the mood music down in Mello, looking sort of like overstocks for the next sort of 12 months?
Actually, reasonably upbeat. I think a lot of people have got quite balanced portfolios, you know, where they've got some money in US stocks that they've done very well on. They've got some, you know, smaller mid-caps in the UK. And of course, FTSE stocks have done well this year. So there was a generally upbeat tone. And most people I spoke to were saying, look, the gulf between large caps and small caps is now so wide. You know, you're bound to, every time that's happened historically, you get a reversion to the mean and a narrowing of that gap. So, yeah, I would say overall investor sentiment, very surprisingly upbeat. Everyone, of course, wants to know about AI. That was the hotly discussed topic with a wide range of opinions, I've got to say.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I mean, I think when I speak to a lot of the fund managers actually at the moment, they're all quite very cautious, actually. I think the most of it is the budget on Wednesday.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, everybody's sick and tired of waiting now for the budget. But I think that could, you know, ever the optimist, that could at least people can plan and people can actually decide whether or not they want to make big purchases or big capex once the budget's out the way. So I think it'll be a bit like releasing a brake, actually, from what I'm picking up from people. Yeah.
Good. Okay, well, we've got plenty of questions coming in for particular stocks. And the stock of the day, obviously, is CMC Markets, which current shares are up 27% today after a trading update, better than expected, saying they're seeing a lot of benefits from their platform B2B business. So what was your take on it?
Very positive. Yeah, we spotted this before 8 a.m. and put out a note at about 5 to 8. On this and about seven or eight other companies today that were either ahead or below. Yeah, a 10% upgrade to its NOI, that's net operating income, I think, guidance. That's from the company itself. I haven't been able to track down any broker notes, unfortunately, but the company's told us it's a 10% upgrade ahead of market expectations. Really, really good. It's obviously a bit like, well, it is a spread betting firm. You know, they're quite volatile. Market volatility actually helps them make more money because people trade more. So it said ahead of expectations. There was a notable 77% increase in the H1 dividend as well. So, yeah, these were H1 results. And it's always had a lovely balance sheet. I mean, we've been positive on this for a long time now, and it was one of those interesting ones that, you know, it's no good waiting for good results and then thinking you can buy in for 4 or 5% more. This thing gapped up at the open. You couldn't, you know, the very first trades of the day I think were about £2.55 or £2.45. So people who hold, we were talking about this at Mello on stage. We were saying to people, look, it's no good sitting on the sidelines and waiting for more certainty because things just gap up. So well done to people who held it, but it was strikingly cheap beforehand. And it's a very good share, I think, CMC Markets. Yeah.
Yeah. And is it still buy? I mean, it's still, even though the market, even though the shares have risen a lot, it's still only 10.5 times PE and on a 5% dividend yield.
Yeah, and it's got that bulletproof balance sheet as well. I mean, I rode the wave on these from a pound up to about £3 a couple of years ago, actually. And I'm really surprised it came back to £2 odd, because we've had quite good updates from it. But these type of businesses, you also think IG Index, plus 500, they don't tend to get on high multiples of earnings. I'm surprised it was up 30% today, I have to say. I didn't expect that. I thought, oh, it'll probably go up 10 or 15%. So 30, surprising, isn't it? It just shows you get some good news and bang, it just gaps up.
Yeah, so I think I think the market actually were viewing, because of the beat, was on their B2B side, and where that's where they offer their platform to other banks. So people like Westpac, I think they were talking about a transformational deal, and other sort of like particular finance institutions. And they, and I think the market is viewing that as a recurring revenue, less cyclical type.
Could be.
And that's why the shares have gone up significantly, because people realize now it's turning into a bit of a platform. Well, the other thing which I found was really quite interesting is that they seem to think that the crypto era is going to be an absolute goldmine to them, because they're going to do fractional shares. So essentially, they do spread bets and CFDs, and they reckon splitting shares into sort of like fractional ownership through Bitcoin and through blockchain technology will allow them then to basically have more market, you know, more markets, and you can do it for 24/7. So, and obviously you can follow the sun all the way around the world as well. It was really quite an interesting. They're very upbeat about the blockchain, basically. And
yeah, interesting. I mean, I'm certainly not. I think it's a lot of nonsense. But you know, if it doesn't really matter what I think, if other people are punting trillions and whatever on it. But you've also got a platform I use just for a little sip, just to try it out. Really, try out the platform. They do fractional share ownership as well, don't they? So that does seem to be, which makes a lot of sense. If you're starting out and you're only putting a few hundred quid a month or something into a trading account, you want zero commission. And fractional share ownership means you can buy some, you know, shares, particularly in the US, with very high nominal share prices. So all of those innovations are good, I think, as long as people don't get carried away and start using gearing, because that, of course, has been the story of my life, really, getting things wrong. It's always the gearing that clobbers me, you know, so I always warn people away from that.
Yeah, it works well on the upside, but it can be a bit of a nasty outcome on the downside. Okay, let's move to, we've got Drew, he's asking about PZ Cousins, basically the consumer sort of like personal care type brands. They do soaps and they do tanning, but they came out with a positive AGM trading update and the shares are up 13% at the moment. So they're having a good day as well. What's your take on it?
Well, this is a stock that Lord Lee flagged up to me and many other investors in one of his podcasts. And I think he's onto something with this one. So we've been positive on it for a while, actually, on my Substack. I don't hold them personally. I had a bit of a portfolio cull 2 or 3 weeks ago when I was worried about general market exposure. So I cut my geared positions down. And unfortunately, this is one of the ones I sold. So obviously, I'm wishing I hadn't now. But yeah, AGM trading update, I thought today was very good. Group like-for-like revenues, this is in H1, of course, were up 9%. That's like-for-like as well. And the best element, again, quite surprisingly maybe, is Africa. Like-for-like revenues up 25%. Now, I'm assuming that's converted into sterling, because obviously with depreciating currencies in Africa, you know, you would expect the nominal increase to be high. But I think it must be, because they've upgraded the profit guidance as well by about 4%, and that's in sterling. So, and it says an H1 profit weighting, which you don't often hear, do you? It's nearly always, it'll be an H2 weighting. But they say H1 profit weighting due to higher marketing spend planned in H2. So that's quite nice. That's all under control. And they're going to give an update on the strategic review, I think they said in January or February, because they're looking to dispose of some of the other African businesses. And Lord Lee's view on this is that the African businesses are worth a lot more than the stock market is giving them the credit for. And today's news showing that the like-for-like revenue growth there was the strongest kind of backs that up. So I think this was a good update on PZ Cousins, and it makes you, it very much reinforces the bull case, and it still looks cheap, I would say.
Yeah, I would agree. I think certainly Lord Lee's sort of investment case, talking about this extra value in that African business. I think they've got a joint venture, haven't they, in palm oil and edible oils, in cooking oil
stuff.
And that, I think that's what's been performing really well, because palm oil prices have been up, and therefore that sort of chimes with theirs. But what that does mean, because they're selling it and it will probably be sold to their joint venture partner on an EBITDA type multiple, it means... Right. It means that it justifies the price, because the business is, it looks as though it's absolutely flying. I mean, to be up revenues, was it 25% like for like?
Yeah, like for like.
I mean, that is fabulous. In fact, it comes to the question, why are you selling it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think it's more about market perception than, because the market just doesn't think these African businesses are any good, but it's clear that they are. Mm. So I think the sum of the parts type argument. What we need now is Harwood to crop up in the shareholder register.
I think you're right. Okay, good. We've got Sue. She's asking about one we're going to have to eat a humble pie on is McBride, private label sort of cleaning and game personal products. Came out with a inline trading update. So it's a bit of a relief rally, but they also did a share buyback. Anyway, the shares have absolutely flown off the tape today. What was your take on it?
Well, it's not one for eating humble pie, because we've been positive on this all year. So we've reported on it amber green, and we've stayed at amber green today. So no, we like it. But as you and I have discussed previously, the question mark is whether it can sustain these 7% operating margins, or whether it falls back to the 5% long-term operating margin at best that it previously held. So it was purely a debate over that point. But no, this was very, very good, this update today. They've announced a £20 million buyback, which is quite substantial. It's about 10% of the market cap. And they said they might even push that to significantly more. And they said they believe the shares are fundamentally undervalued, because it's only a PE of 6 or something. So I can't argue with any of that. I thought this was a really good update. And so the question remains, what will the long-term margins be? And I think you've done some work on that, haven't you, Paul? So shall I hand it over to you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had a quick conversation with the CEO, and he was adamant that they could do consistent EBIT margin. I think it was 6 or 7% on a long-term basis, whereas right. Obviously the value that sort of like 6x PE suggests it's only about 3 or 4, and they're going to, that profit margin is going to compress. But let's be clear about it. Private label still seems to be winning the day at the checkout, because around Europe, you know, people are basically looking for bargains and cheaper deals. And if a product performs similarly to a brand, then you pick up your supermarket own brand, which is perfect for these guys. And as long as that business case lasts, I think also what he was talking about is that, you know, the functionality of some of the products are now so much better, the private label ones, that
the formulation,
the formulations that they can actually justify, you know, a better price point. And also, I think the brands are not that interested in creating a price war either. They're using a lot of their existing brands as sort of like cash cows, and therefore there's not huge pricing pressure from the brands, like huge amounts of discounting. But anyway, I'm with you. I would still be hesitant myself, because you and I have been, we're long in the tooth. We've seen this like 30, 40 years. I mean, I used to work for a branded manufacturer, you know, and it was always the same. Once it got really tough, then everything was struggling, and private label always got really beaten up badly. But hopefully things have changed.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a question of competition, isn't it? There must be thousands of factories all over the world that can manufacture these products. So, you know, if your margins are getting up to 6-7%, that you would imagine the supermarket customers will just start hammering them and pushing those margins back down again, isn't it? So, but so far, there's no evidence that has happened. So I think the bull case is definitely strengthening, and we love the stuff about the buyback today. So I think the strong bounce in the shares, yeah, looks fully justified. Doesn't really interest me. I mean, it's been a stunning turnaround. There's no doubt about it from 2022. But if you look back at the circumstances in 2022, it was right on the brink of going bust. And it was only a friendly bank manager who gave them some time to trade their way out of it that saved the day. And looking back, that was the key announcement, when they actually got the bank facilities renewed, you know, refreshed when the share price was totally bombed out. That was a signal that we should have leapt onto this one. So, but a few of the readers did, so well done to them. And it does still have quite a cash hungry pension deficit, I believe. I think they said today £7 million or something went into the pension fund. Right. And they've also spent a similar amount on lobbing money over to the employee benefit trust. So the directors are scooping out a nice wad for themselves. But, you know, look at the share price. Nobody's going to complain, are they?
Well, I think if it's undervalued, which they think it is, then putting it into the employee benefits trust is probably not a bad idea, because it generates value if you're buying it less than intrinsic.
Yeah, and doing a buyback when you're on a PE of 6, you know, yeah. And it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I can't stand these buybacks that companies do where on the really expensive tech stocks. Like, I was looking at the Mag 7 accounts for all of them the other day. They're doing huge buybacks on massive PE ratios. Doesn't make any sense at all, other than to obscure how generous the share options have been, you know. So when you adjust all that out, you know, the figures are nowhere near as good as they initially look, no. I would suggest.
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, good. Let's move to another company. We've actually chatted to them. Phil's asking about PayPoint, which basically does sort of payments in convenience stores. I think he came out with a trading update or some results this morning. Anyway, the shares have been really hammered, actually. They're down 17%.
Really surprised with that, because me and my team, I mean, because the conversation you and I had with them was pretty upbeat, wasn't it? They gave us a sort of briefing of all the various parts of, yeah, look at that share price. Mm. I was really surprised by this. I didn't see this coming at all. It was this morning. And the actual main part of the RNS was okay. This was H1 results out today. Revenue was up 7%. PBT was down 4.5%. Okay, that doesn't sound too bad. But then in the outlook section, they were talking about macro and business challenges. And there'd been two, I don't think they fully explained what these problems are, but there'd been some sort of operational problems that have emerged. Which have induced the broker, Pamuel Ibram, to drop the forecast for next year by 11%. And they've said it's going to take them longer than expected to reach the target of 100 million EBITDA. So I think an 18% drop in share price when I last looked does look a bit severe. But it's kind of now, we were green on it. We've dropped it two notches down to amber, because we just think, well, this was a bit of a bolt from the blue, really. And I don't like those type of profit warnings, really. And I think they've been over generous with shareholder returns. So they might have to scale those back. I think they were putting a question mark over that as well. So I think we need to wait and see and get more information on this. But yeah, I'm no longer positive on it, because this has just come out of the blue. So I've dropped it down to neutral. So have you looked at it today, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, I did actually get my head around the reasons why, because I think the main one was in their sort of like online delivery business. And it appears as though their two biggest customers, or two of their largest customers, InPost and Yodel, have merged. And they did that. InPost bought them in April. And so consequently, what's happened is that I think there's been a lot of sort of like price negotiation about how big a share, because they've got obviously extra leverage, what pricing going forward. And I think they've had that sort of negotiation. I think that's what's taken some of the air out of that particular part of the business. That's how I read it anyway. And then the other part...
Paul, is that the deal where the Czech Sphinx bought, Royal Mail bought 49% of it? Is it connected to that? Oh, it's not? Okay.
No. No, it's separate. This is basically the in-store where you just drop your you know, your parcel off or pick it up, and it's they basically just act as the conduit that prints off the form that gives you the, you know, your receipt that you've dropped the form off, and then Impos will come or Yodel will come and collect it, and then likewise you can pick it up, and they'll just do the software basically. They basically take a clip off that particular transaction, and I read that was such that with the increased buying power of those customers, it's led to a decrease in the amount of value that they get. And then the other part of it was there was a new service when we chatted to, I think it was Steve and Rob, wasn't it? Rob was the CFO, and I think Steve was talking about this new Ob Connect business, which basically verifies payee, confirmation of payee when you want to pay somebody, and that's a bit of software. And I think they've had sort of that's taken quite a bit of time, longer than they anticipated, to get actually implemented in a proper. So I think those two are the moving parts that have led to effectively the profit warning today. But I'm with you. Yeah. I was surprised it was so severe. Actually, I mean they're trading. Yeah. They're trading at now on adjusted numbers of less than 7.5x PE.
But it's got a ropey balance sheet with a fair bit of debt. So that without, if you made it cash neutral, your PE would probably be nearer 10, which arguably, why would you rate it at more than that? So, yeah, I think this is not a disaster by any means, but it's a definite bump in the road. And from what you were saying on the first part of the business, that just sounds like competitive pressures, doesn't it? It's just customers squeezing their margins because there's competition. So, yeah, I must admit, it's easy to let an 18% share price fall sort of cloud your judgment to the value, isn't it? But I think it might take a while for confidence to return in this one, because it's a bit of a, not ideal, is it, really? Coming out of the blue. That's what I don't like. I like them to set forecasts, meet or beat. You know, we it's just when something just completely random happens and suddenly 10% or more of the profit's gone, it's bound to unsettle people, isn't it?
I think Harwood would be buying more shares, actually, because I think they own a slug, don't they? I think this is
Do they?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. When you talk about, you know, valuation, it's 5.5x EBITDA and 6.5x EBIT. I mean, okay, if you put 25% on the 6.5x EBIT, i.e. you're doing a cash neutral, then what's that? 8.5x PE? I mean, we're not talking of a racy valuation, albeit I think the investment thesis is still there. What it means is just, this is a bit of a bump in the road they need to work through. But I would be not surprised if Harwood nudge up their ownership, actually.
Yeah, it could be. And I mean, the other thing is it might attract a bid for the whole group. We were talking about that when we last spoke about this one, I think, given that they've sold 49% of I can't remember what it's called, but you know, the Royal Mail could come back and buy the whole thing, maybe. I don't know. So it could go either way, couldn't it? But I'm certainly, you've got to bear in mind as well, the core business, the main cash generator, is in slow structural decline. This is the little yellow terminals in the corner shops. You know, I know they're trying to leverage that whole network with other activities, but you're never going to get on a premium rating with this because of that core main cash generator actually being in slow gradual decline, I suspect.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move on to, we've got Vicky. She's asking about now a small cap is Arcado. So, you know, basically the robotics fulfillment center company that has got their own brand. It sells groceries in the UK, but effectively licenses out its technology for robotic sort of like solutions for groceries. Anyway, it lost a contract, not lost a contract, but it seems as though it's one of its largest customers in the US, Kroger, have decided to downsize that particular contract, if not ultimately to move out. But the shares, I mean, I think they're about in the 90% club from their highs in 2021, and they're now certainly mid cap, if not small cap.
Yeah, I mean, I've been a long-term bear on this. I've been bearish on it pretty much from when it first listed. So, as I always joke, I was about 15 years too early with my bearishness. But yeah, no, I think it's a lousy business model. It's never made a profit. It quotes EBITDA, but actually they have huge depreciation and capex charges and huge finance charges. Arcado, this is it's surviving on junk bonds, which are very expensive. The balance sheet, is very, very capital intensive, and I think it's hopeless. It just, it's not a viable business model. But we were told that this technology was going to be taken up by international distribution groups. Well, Kroger is a big, I think, retailer or distributor or something in America, isn't it? Well, they're closing three out of the eight sites that use Ocado Kit. Now, what's strange about this was that we actually reported on this on the 12th of September when Kroger said that the deal was at risk. So I don't really understand why it dropped 17% 2 days ago when Kroger just confirmed, yeah, we're closing some of these warehouses. And Ocado is expecting to get $250 million compensation from Kroger in return for losing $50 million a year in fees. Well, that again says to me, just confirms to me that this technology isn't cost effective. If Kroger are prepared to shell out $250 million for breach of contract, what's that telling you about Ocado's kit? I mean, it says to me that there's not really a commercial case for it. So, yeah, very bearish on Ocado. I remain. I think it could go bust.
Yeah, no, I think Kroger, they said when their announcement that they're going to change their delivery schedule of fresh perishable groceries to Uber Eats and to, basically... Yeah. And to people who just do, sort of quick sort of like turnaround sort of deliveries. And so that's the case to deliver the shopping. I mean, I think you're right. I think it absolutely just blows the whole investment case of putting robotic fulfillment centers together for groceries where there's short shelf life, perishable goods, and people want it immediately. And I actually think Tesco's has got it right, because we're a country, obviously, with high density of population. So if you were to put robotics in, it would make sense to do it. But... Tesco has always used its supermarkets as fulfillment centers, and I think that makes perfect sense,
because the supermarkets are basically warehouses, aren't they? I agree with you. And having an illegal migrant on a bike is probably cheaper than using billions of pounds worth of robots in a distribution center, isn't it? You can edit that out if you want to.
You're getting a bit controversial there. We'll talk.
No, it was a joke, isn't it?
Well, I know it was. Yeah, no, we'll talk. We should talk about the government, shouldn't we? Lunatics running the asylum. Okay, right. Let's move to we've got Stephen Griffiths is asking about Traxys, who came out with the full year results today. These are guys who do specialist hardware and software for the rail industry. About 33% of the revenues are recurring. They came out with a strong second half, which I think they'd already talked about. But the shares have responded favourably on a pretty much a relief rally, I think. But what was your take?
Yeah, we sort of predicted that, didn't we? I think last week or the week before, we were saying it was looking interesting again at around £3. So the latest figure I've got here for today is up 9% to £3.50. I didn't look at this, but my colleague Dave did. And his notes here, he's put improved H2 trading, like you said. 24.8p EPS. So that puts the PE only on about, 14 or something? Is that right, I think?
I've got 13, actually. But 13.
Yeah, which is good because it's got net cash as well, which is real net cash, 23 million. That's almost a quarter of the market cap. Q1 trading in the new financial year, because it's a July year end, I think, isn't it, is in line. We can't get hold of any broker notes, usual problem. So we think it's a quality company. Some end market challenges, Dave's written here, but we're green on it, which is our top 5 out of 5 score on it. Remember, we're value and GARP, growth at reasonable price investors. So no, we think it looks good. So I might have to revisit that myself. So
yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, given we've had a perfect storm in rail tech because of the delays to CP7 and the Great British Railways sort of stopping a lot of investment, these guys have actually done a flat performance in a really tough period. If that's the worst that it gets and it's on 13 times, then actually you could find, okay, this has been a good tester to sort of like rubber stamp the business case. And once we start seeing growth and digitization of all that rail industry and improving the technology, then this should be a key beneficiary, because these could be one of the key suppliers left standing, because I bet you some small players are dropping out.
Yeah, it is an interesting group. It's kind of lost its momentum, hasn't it, in terms of strategy in the last few years. I think they did some unimpressive sort of acquisitions a few years back, and it's all gone a bit quiet on the M&A front. But I suppose that's better than them just buying any old rubbish at too high a price, isn't it? And the former CEO, John MacArthur, is he a non-exec now? I think he's looking for more acquisitions, I think, and they've got a cash pile. So that could be a trigger for a re-rating, maybe, if they crank up the M&A a bit. Yeah, fundamentally, quite a nice, reasonably priced business, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the CEO was actually Chris Barnes, I think it was previously, but hey-ho.
Didn't they change the CEO recently?
It's a new guy called David Frost. Not the interviewer, I presume. Okay, good. We've got HJ Harani. He's asking about JD Sports, which I know you've liked a lot. They came out with a trading update today? Shares are just nudged down a touch. What was your view?
Yeah, that's right. Gosh, they're all asking about things that have reported today. So it's a good thing I did. Me and the team did a proper report today. JD Sports Fashion, JD Dot. It was a Q3 trading update, which they said was solid, which is nearly as bad as resilient. The like-for-like revenues year-to-date are down 2.2%. So we've known for a long while that JD Sports is not struggling, I would say, but is not having the best of times because macro's tough, consumer's tough. You've got tariffs, there's a lot of the businesses in the US, of course. It's not a UK business. And it's nudged down, the exact words they use for the full year, so the guidance for the full year, January 26, was within the lower end of current market expectations. So it's I worked out it's about 2% below consensus if you do the numbers. So I actually, this was again pre-8 a.m. as I like guessing what's likely to happen. I just said I think the soft trading is already in the price. The PE is only 6.7, so 2% miss I didn't think would move the price very much. And when I last looked, it was down 3%. So, yeah, the market's largely shrugged it off, I think, because, it's in the price. And it's dirt cheap, I think. You know, any sort of signs of recovery in demand. And of course, the US economy, they're threatening to give all these tax checks, aren't they? $2,000 or something. I think they'll find a way of reflating the US economy, and the tariff stuff is all settling now. So I think it might be worth revisiting, actually, JD Sports on that sort of valuation. 51% owned by Pentland, isn't it? So you're probably not going to get takeover bids unless Pentland decide to take, offer for the minorities. But yeah, I think it looks very interesting, actually. And the Q3 update, it's tough macro. So obviously, anything consumer focused is probably going to be struggling a little bit, and of course they are selling third-party brands, aren't they? So they haven't necessarily got that much pricing power. Competition is discounting, I believe. So I thought, taking everything into account, I thought actually that was a creditable Q3 update. So yeah. What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think they're cheap. I mean, 6.5x PE. We're not a lot of growth in there. They didn't seem to benefit from Nike having an improving trading environment. But I think Nike sales, where they saw a lot of growth, was actually in China, actually. So it probably chimes is consistent. But I think you raised the best point, because I have seen a lot about the States next year, because I've seen quite a few of the big merchant banks. I think Apollo Global also said today that the big, beautiful tax bill should increase GDP by about 1% next year in the US. And that's aimed at largely consumers, isn't it? So if you're right, if they're basically dishing out all the tariffs to consumers, to what they're going to spend on sneakers is as good as any, isn't it? Houses and all kinds of stuff. So I think I'm with you, actually. I think this has got probably a bit of a coiled spring, actually. Again, we've seen the worst, and the American economy should get back on its feet next year.
I think it will, or might do, rather, because none of us know for sure. And I mean, you've got all this spending on the AI and on all the infrastructure, the data centers, the electricity networks all having to be hugely upgraded in America. I think you've got the seeds there for a really powerful economic recovery in America.
Good. Okay, let's move next. We've got Craig Worrell asking about a small cap that I know you own. It's Plexus. He says, what are your thoughts on? They had a contract win last week, didn't they? And they talked about, I think it was like Tough Macro or something like that. But anyway, what was your latest view on Plexus, the oil field services company that does this PosGrip that helps sort of like stop off methane leaks in oil wells?
Yeah, well, it's very difficult to know because they're terrible for news flow. It just goes, you know, you just go months and months and months and months with nothing, no updates at all. It's really frustrating. And I have complained to management about it. I tried to get in touch with them 6 weeks ago or something. I've not had a reply. So the only thing is that's worrying me is the accounts are now late, the June accounts, which makes you wonder if they're having trouble getting the going concern thing signed off again. I mean, in the past, the founder basically bankrolled it with temporary loans and things. So, and they've said, you know, they're absolutely committed to the listing because it means they don't have to sign any personal guarantees. The oil majors that they deal with, you know, just everything gets waved through because it's a stock market listed company. So I haven't got anything new on it. I thought the contract win a week or two was encouraging. It was to do with plug and abandonment in the North Sea. And this is really Plexus's original work that was where they actually set up a lot of these wells in the North Sea. So they've got all the original paperwork for when the wells were first drilled and everything, which generally has been lost by, so they've got a wealth of IP in the business, but struggling to get sustainable results. So I'm just in the lap of the gods. I mean, for me personally, this share, I've just put it in a side pocket. I'm not trading it at all. I'm just going to, and I'll accept whatever the outcome is. You know, I mean, if it works and if they get some decent contract wins again, because I bought two and a half years ago when they won this record contract on high margins, £9 million, which apparently saved the client something like 150 million euros, that one contract. So, I mean, that technology, that just says to you, this technology is incredibly valuable if they can commercialize it. And plug and abandonment is, I think, an exciting area. So it was good that Plexus have won a contract, but it was only a framework agreement, so a sort of call-off thing, so they couldn't put in any numbers on it. But I mean, it was better to hear that than nothing, I suppose. So it's not for widows and orphans. I wouldn't encourage anyone else to buy the share. You know, it's one I hold, but it's too high risk, I think, for unless we get some good news, of course, then we could reassess it.
Yeah, I actually did speak to I've got a friend who's a geophysicist. He's an expert in this whole area. He used to work for Shell and he also worked for CNOOC, I think the Chinese guys, but out in the North Sea. So he was doing a lot of this plug and abandonment and sort of like how the technology and the actual regulation. I asked him, how do you do it? And he says, well, there's three grades. The first grade is you just fill it with cement. You get, if you want a higher specification, you fill it with another lot of cement. And if you want the highest grade that you need currently under regulation for plug it, you fill it with a third layer of cement. There was no need at all for PosGrip. And what I said to him, have you ever use it? And he says, well, it may be, you know, used for really sort of niche areas that it really works well. You've got difficulty. But he says basically most of the plug and abandonment is you just fill it with cement and that's how they do it. But he did say as a positive, the carbon capture type applications, they require a higher level of regulation to plug and abandonment, you know, to actually stop it. And he thought that it might well work, you know, better for that. But the main, I think it isn't, he's an expert in, he's a geophysicist expert in the whole industry. And he said, you know, what they just do the cheapest, easiest solution, whatever the regulation says, which is basically fill it with three lots of cement, you know.
Well, that was what went wrong with the original wellhead business in 2015. Demand just dried up. And I mean, at that point, it was a 300 million market cap company. Yeah. And it was a profitable growth story, you know, but then business just dried up because everyone started buying all these cheap Chinese things, which, of course, leak methane at an appalling rate, which has only recently been discovered by satellites. So it does all hinge on regulation for sure. But it's specialized kit. But, you know, the £9 million contract that saved the client $150 million, you know, shows that there is a need for this. I think it's mainly in high temperature and high pressure environments. So I'm sure your friend's right that this kit is not, you know, needed universally, but where it is needed, it performs a vital function, you know, as the figures show.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Okay, let's move sectors. We've got Brian. He's asking about Bloomsbury, the publisher, who we actually did chat, had a fantastic conversation to the CEO.
It was great, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, with the CEO, Nigel Newton, and also a big thanks to the IR director, Tamsin Garrity, I think it was. What was your take from our conversation with Brian? Because it does seem as though that consumer business is a bit of a gold mine in terms of the authors that they've signed and, you know, the longevity of those the publications.
Oh, well, it was just such an enjoyable session, I have to say. He was the founder, Nigel, was sitting there in his library, just surrounded by books, piled up to the roof practically all around him. It was great. And very dry sense of humour and, terrific guy. These subjective factors do matter. I love investing in entrepreneurial businesses, owner-managed businesses. And he was just fizzing with enthusiasm for the whole thing, wasn't he? Which, again, you wouldn't necessarily expect from somebody who's, set the thing up decades ago. But no, he was very upbeat, wasn't he? I've got pages and pages of notes on it. Basically, it seems obvious to me these shares are too cheap. And I think the 2 to 3 year outlook for it, really, there was loads of things. I think he listed, didn't he, 14, I think he went to 14 in the end, reasons why, Bloomsbury's looking good. And I think he's right. P is about 12, net cash balance sheet, I think. They've got this knack of finding early stage authors, fiction writers who go on to become monsters of the sector. They spotted J.K. Rowling, and you asked him, didn't you, how do you get these successful authors onto your books, like Sarah J. Maas, and there's a third one, all female, interestingly enough. And he just said, well, they weren't successful authors. We got J.K. Rowling for $2,000 because 12 other publishers had turned her down. So they've got something there, haven't they? Entrepreneurial. He said that word over and over again throughout the Zoom. And I was very, very, I almost made this my top share idea in Mellow yesterday, but I decided to do Gleeson instead, which you'll be pleased about because you like that one, Paul, don't you? But it was a close toss up between Bloomsbury, Gleeson and ME Group. Those are my kind of three value oversold, decent quality small cap shares. So I loved it. I thought Bloomsbury looks, I must buy some. I did have a few recently, but I need to get a new position in on that.
Yeah, the thing which really stood out to me was the symbiotic relationship between books and films, because you start off with an author who does a series of books like Harry Potter with J.K. Rowling. They then create some movies and that boosts obviously the book sales. And now they're doing a spin out. They're doing a new TV series of 56 episodes. And that's sort of like, again, boost the book sales. So I think there's a huge link between movies and books. And he's doing the same thing with Sarah J. Maas, who's currently, I think, negotiating deals with Hollywood in terms of doing movies for her books. And clearly that's going to be a huge benefit for, basically previous sales on the back catalogue going forward. And then they have another one, don't they? Catherine Rundell, who's just inked a deal to do one of their books for Disney. And so consequently, it's a symbiotic relationship between books and films. And so the longevity of a book is actually much longer. It can be decades, or a series of books can be decades rather than actual years. Because the 25 years ago, I remember Bloomsbury, and the market had written it off because they thought the end of the Harry Potter series was going to be terminal for the business. But look, it's just still a huge, great, big profit earner for them. So that's the, and I'm with you, I think the consumer business is absolutely fantastic. And then this academic professional publishing business, which is about a third of the revenues, they're trying to build that business with sort of recurring revenues, high gross margins, which is actually the case. And they've inked a deal with one of the big AI large language model guys. Mm. So it's going to be an opportunity there, but it could potentially be a threat. But regardless of that, even if you put a zero value on the professional and the academic, the consumer division is just a crown jewel. So I was with you. I came away and I was blown away. I thought this was fantastic business, actually. I'm amazed, yeah, I haven't bought any more shares again.
Yeah, it was one of the best calls we've had, I think. And yeah, it was, as you say, on the film side of it, I think I've read on sort of bulletin board chats, when they talk about film deals, they say, oh, well, Bloomsbury don't get any royalties from that, so forget it. Whereas what Nigel was saying to us is, actually, when the films do come out, it hugely stimulates the back catalogue of book sales, massively. So I think, you know, he said there might be a film deal with Sarah J. Maas, as you said, which could further stimulate the books. And also, I think some sort of streaming or something for J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter. He reckons that will be very bullish for the book sales over the next couple of years. So, yeah, no, I was amazed at how upbeat he is. But in a measured way, you know, I didn't feel he's some sort of, you know, ramper just telling you all the great stuff. He was just rattling off facts and figures, just what you want from an owner-managed business. So, yeah, I'm very keen on Bloomsbury. I must get some shares in it.
Likewise. Okay, good. Let's move sectors. We've got Damien. He's asking about building products company Alumask, which we chatted to these guys the day before. We spoke to Simon Dre, the group finance director, and also the CEO. But Paul, anyway, we had
Paul, I think his name.
I can't remember. Sorry,
didn't we have one call where we had three Pauls on it?
Oh, that's right. It was Paul Hooper, wasn't it? Paul Hooper, the
Paul
CEO.
Hooper, yeah,
who's actually retiring, isn't he? But anyway, these guys do sort of roofing and venting, vent type products, and also big stormwater drains and stuff. They came out with a trading update, which they said would have been slightly softer than expected because of everything sort of slowing down heading into the actual budget. But again, I think we had an excellent conversation. What was your sort of takes on it?
I thought it was great. I mean, I've always liked Alumask. I think when you look at what the shares and the profits have done over the last 5 years, it's absolutely extraordinary in this really tough macro. They've just delivered and delivered and delivered. They've had a little bit of a wobble recently, as you correctly say. This was we marked it as a profit warning, actually. It was on the 24th of October. And I must admit, I had to chuckle, but I was a bit embarrassed at the time. He said, oh, he's quite sort of debonair and affable, isn't he, Paul Hooper? And he said to me, oh, and he said, Paul Scott, he said, we understand you put us on the naughty step. And this is a classification I have for where companies give a vague outlook statement and then slip through a profit warning via the broker. And I went, ah, yes, yes. He said, actually, we understood the point you were making and we've taken it on board. So I thought that was a nice touch. And he said, look, in terms of, I think he used the phrase, we can't defy gravity forever, meaning that, you know, in tough macro, it's very, very difficult to outperform year after year. But it wasn't a big profit warning. I think it was only 6% or something. And they do seem to have really good product innovation, really good pricing power. I think it's a lovely quality business if you look at the quality metrics. And a lot of scope for them to bring out new products. I see this as more of a buying opportunity than a threat. But you obviously have to bear in mind that sometimes once you've had one profit warning, you know, there might be more bad news to come. So that is a risk, isn't it? So personally, I would be tempted to take a half position size in this myself.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's the highest quality building products company actually in the UK, certainly in the small and mid caps sector. And you look at the margins and it's sort of 13-14% EBIT yeah. margins. And when we chatted to him, you can understand why, because the vast majority of their products have real pricing power. And particularly one, I think they talked about Timlock, which is that roof sort of venting and loft door type business, which has got competitors, but they're the lowest cost producer, even though they've still got plenty of spare capacity in their facility. And I think that, and then you sort of mentioned about potentially increasing the R&D in that area and really trying to grow that and internationalize it. And he said he was thinking about putting some more resource into it, plus increasing the overseas side of it.
Yeah, I saw him jot that point down and I thought, oh, good, I've said something intelligent. but yeah, and I mean, he did say as well, you guys must come and visit our factory. He said it's the best run factory. He said some investors have been there and said it's the best run factory they've ever seen. So he was really not taking the credit for himself for it. He was just saying we've got a fantastic team, you know, with fantastic management. And he said it's all about service as well. They do next day delivery straight to the trade, and they've developed some sort of, a window that you put into a roof, you know, a skylight type thing, slanting one. I can't remember what they're called. But he said they've developed one that can be fitted by one workman, and they deliver them any size within 24 hours. And he said that therefore they are just the go-to place for that particular product. And it can be a bit more expensive than the competition, but it'll be perfect. The quality will be perfect. It'll fit as it's meant to fit. And that's why they can charge more for it. And then they guarantee delivery next day. So, yeah, I mean, it just feels such a good quality company, Ali Musk.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Okay, good. Let's move. Similar sort of sector. Let's go to, got Paul the Parrot. He's asking about Grainger, the UK's biggest private landlord. Good results, he says, yet a poor market reaction. Debt shares are down 2% today.
Yeah, I mean, anything can happen on results day at the moment, can't it? Sometimes you look at things and think, why has that gone up? And then the opposite as well. So a 3% move, I would just say, is normal volatility. But yeah, this is September 25 results came out today. Adjusted EPS was down 2% on last year. So yeah, slight miss on consensus, we think. John, my other colleague, wrote these notes. Outlook for the full year is unchanged. You do have quite a big discount to NAV. Very significant discount to NAV. Loan to value is 38%, which is fine. Yeah, 30% discount. 4.5% yield. You can get better yields on other REITs, but we both like this one, Grainger, don't we? It's residential, but a build to rent residential properties, it does. Do you want to take it over here, Paul? Because I think you know you own this one, don't you?
I bought it basically because it's a long-term income generator on a cheap valuation, and it's a proxy for buying a second home. If you don't want to own the hassle of renting your house out or a room out, then buy shares in Grainger, because that's basically what it is. And I think if it basically just carries on trading in for the next 5 or 7, I think you'll see an uplift of 30% to net tangible assets eventually, because it will just become as like an income stock as a REIT. It's got inflation proof, so it's low risk. Mm. But I actually think it won't last 5 years. I actually think either Lloyds or Land Securities are going to buy this, because they want to expand and get much bigger in build to rent and into be a private landlord. And right. So this is a nice size for them to become the number one player and then to get economies of scale. So I would, or one of the big infrastructure plays. So I'm just sitting on this, not expecting anything massive. And it doesn't need to, because it's so cheap and it's all asset backed. And I think house prices will continue to get to track GDP actually going forward.
Yeah, that makes sense completely to me. I mean, this is another one where we had a call. I think it was the corporate affairs director who gave us a masterclass, really, in how this sector works. The only thing I would say is that if you just want an inflation-proofed income, there are higher yields. We looked at a couple today, actually. London Metric Property, that's a similar-sized REIT, 6.6% yield. inflation-proofed income there. And there was also, what was the other one? We had another. Oh, it was Grainger, actually. Supermarket REIT as well announced today, and that has an 8% dividend yield. So what do you think about that? What made you prefer Grainger if you were looking for income then, Paul?
One, because it's the number one player in this in the UK and therefore is an acquisition target. And if it ever gets bought out or alternative the market gets any sense, then it will track towards its net tangible assets, which is £3 a share. So effectively, if you've got another 30% over 10 years and you add to the 5% dividend yield, it's 5% and 3%. It's 8% compound in anybody's day over 10 years. I just thought, OK, it's a low risk inflation proofed housing play. Where I haven't got to do anything in terms of renting stuff out. I just collect the dividend because it's a REIT. It makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? The other thing is an acquirer could put on the standard 30% premium and they'd still be buying it well below NAV, wouldn't they? So, I think that takeover bid idea definitely works, yeah.
Okay, good. Let's go to sectors. We've got Richard Leppington. He's asking about engineering business Trifast that makes sort of like industrial fasteners for sort of like non, it's non-consumer appliances. These are for all industrial applications. Got to manufacturing facilities around the country. I think they came out with a trading update in saying they were doing well in smart infrastructure and healthcare, but actually that had been offset by tariff volatility. And also, I think they'd been hit by the cyber security problem at JLR because that was one of their biggest automotive customers. But the margins are improving. Anyway, I don't know what your take on it. I know Harwood are all over this, and it's still trading at a really low valuation.
Yeah, I know it's one of these. There are quite a lot of them out at the moment. These margin improvement things, isn't it? Operating margin improvement. I don't know, I can never get excited about Trifaster, but H1 results came out, I think this was on Tuesday. EPS was up 10%. The EBIT margin has risen 20 bips to 6.2%, so that's going in the right direction. Yeah, rebalanced due to automotive issues. That must be alluding to JLR. I don't know what rebalanced means. and full year expectations for March 26 were unchanged. It's all right. Self-help progress despite market challenges, my colleague Dave has concluded. Yeah, I can't get madly excited about it, but we're moderately positive. So amber green on Trifast for us. Do you like it, Paul?
I think the Harwood magic, and I know they've put somebody on the non-exec. I think they're all over this. I'd be stunned if they don't deliver on that self-help. And then if they get a following win with extra GDP, then these guys will do very well. And I actually think the CEO's, I can't remember, Ian Percival, I think it is, he's actually doing a really good job because it isn't easy in what you'd think as a commodity. And what they're doing, I think they're following the same model as Nat Rothschild at Volex, i.e. they're going up market into higher value products where they have differentiation and pricing power. And over a 4 or 5 year, you'll see this margin tracking up as they move through the, you know, they upgrade the actual products and improve the pricing. So, yeah, I mean, I don't own it, but I'd bet on the shareholders to make sure that this thing does work, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it often seems to me with these operating profit improvement type shares, a lot of it seems to be just down to poor management. And I think I think one of your fund manager interviews covered this one. And I think they were saying they used to basically let the local branches or individual factories just kind of please the customers rather than saying to them, actually, no, we need to make this target profit margin, which, I mean, seems just so ridiculously basic. I don't know how these companies get into this state, really. And Trifast seems to be permanently restructuring. Ever since I can remember looking at it, it's always restructuring. But look, maybe this time it's going to work. I don't know.
Good. Okay, let's move sector. Let's go to software. We've got Roy is asking about Eagle Eye. That I think, did they come out with a trading update today? They basically, or not today, this week. They do basically promotional software for big grocers. And they inked a contract out in the states in Dallas, or sorry, say in Texas and Mexico as a new one. And then they also had an inline trading update, I think, just recently, and an AGM statement. The shares have sort of ticked up a bit. Any quick thoughts?
I haven't really changed my mind on this. I'm just not sure about it, because they're obviously having to rebuild profitability again from losing that highly lucrative contract. The news flow has been good recently, you're right. There was a five-year contract in North America, wasn't there, announced on Monday, I think, or was that last Monday, I think. And didn't they say they had four new contracts that were either in the pipeline or had been signed? So, yeah, I can't remember the details, Paul, but I think it was kind of upbeat sounding. What are the shares doing? Have you got them up on the...
£2.80 at the moment.
I think that for me, I mean, I can see the potential for Eagle Eye for sure. It is an interesting business. But yeah, I'm just not sure how to value it. So I think you're more positive than... So I'm kind of neutral or moderately positive, but no more than that. But I think you like it more, don't you, Paul?
Yeah, I mean, when we chatted to the CEO, Tim Mason, I mean, I thought he was so committed for the actual business and getting it back up and operational. And this has got huge operating leverage. As soon as you win new contracts, it's 80% gross margins or just drop through to the bottom line. It's cash generative. It's basically got cash on the balance sheet. Yeah. And it hasn't seen any benefits yet from this new channel partner with SAP that has just, they've just started offering that to their customers. And I interpreted the mood music in that trading update that they were pretty confident about signing some deals. And I think on the back of the first one, I can see a material increase in this because they'll because investors will start realizing actually this is going to work. And once they see that, it's been on the show me. I think there's a long way ahead. I mean, I could be. I mean, obviously, I own it, so I'm, you know, bullish on it. But it only trades at 1.7 times sales, and if this grows at double digits, which is what Tim believes it can do, you know, like for like, it'll certainly deliver in the fullness of time 25 or sort of 20% EBITDA margins without any problem at all once it sort of like gets extra sales. And on that basis, it'll be 3.5 times, you know, EV to revenue multiple. And that's double where it currently lies. So I'm very bullish. I think this could be well over £5 in sort of like 1 to 2 years, as long as that SAP agreement comes through, or even, you know, if they basically just carry on winning more business out into the States. So I love it. I think this is one of my highest conviction stocks that I own going into 2026, actually, because I think Tim's going to do it, actually. I think he's really, really committed.
You can't fault him for that. Definitely, I agree. He's really focused, and he was angry about the profit warning, wasn't he? I mean, I didn't think I was particularly blunt, but I just basically said, well, your profit's all gone now, so what are you going to do to rebuild it or something? And he almost lost it, didn't he? He said something like, I think I'm going to be able to control myself or something like that. A little bit passive aggressive, I thought. But anyway, I mean, that's just, by the by, just tittle tattle. But yeah, I think it is a good business. There's no doubt about it. But I haven't quite got over the profit warning yet, personally.
Yeah, well, I almost fell off my chair when you said that. I thought, what is he saying? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay, let's move. We've got Tim. He's asking about CML Microsystems, which is a semiconductor type business. It does low power chips for communication devices. Had a really quite a difficult first half. I think they were hit by three major things. First of all, the relocation costs out from one factory two factories down to one in California. Plus, they had the tail end of inventory destocking, which now seems to finish. And then they got absolutely by the tariffs. And then the reaction from China, they had rare supplier problems in terms of, I think it was gallium, which they had difficulty getting their suppliers to do their compound semiconductors. Anyway, they had a pretty miserable first half, but they did win a big contract, and they're looking to sort of like grow pretty much aggressively now. What was your take? Have we the investment case comes down to, have we reached an inflection point now?
I didn't look at it in detail, but one of my team did a quick review of it. The most recent thing we've got is H1 results to September 25. That was on the 18th of November. So that's 2 days ago. Yeah, that's the most recent thing. So revenue's down 27%. But EPS more than doubled to 11.6p. So that's adjusted EPS. So I'm not sure what happened there. Do you know why the profits were up even though revenue were down, Paul?
Yes, because they had a special land sale or property sale. Effectively, the underlying business was a loss. I think there was a negative of $1 million underlying loss. They were actually showing about 2.8 profit because they'd made best part of 3 or 4 million profit on the land sale.
Right. Oh, I just would have thought that would have been taken out of the adjusted EPS number, but it doesn't look like it has. It says cyclical low end of the market destocking, but improved order intake and some design wins. Material revenue growth expected in H2. Marketing efforts strengthening pipeline. So we haven't got any forecasts. Shore Capital issued a note, but with no forecast, which is very unusual. But you have got bulletproof balance sheet protection at CML. So it's quite a nice each way bet, really. My colleague Dave's concluded here, possible green shoots, maybe worth a deeper look. So too difficult really for us to assess at this stage, but I'm not warning anyone away from it because you've got that nice strong balance sheet. And most years it makes a decent profit, doesn't it?
Yeah, and also I'd say I think the market hasn't yet seen, or if they have seen, it's a show me story. One of their sort of key growth drivers is obviously they've got this digital radio, which is out in India and China, which should do really well over the medium term. They've got the normal sort of industrial stuff with Internet of Things. I mean, I own I own some shares, and it's just for disclosure. But the one thing I think the market hasn't seen yet is how it's going to benefit from low Earth orbit satellites. Because it basically does the transceivers and the antennae that go onto the devices that users will have, maybe even sort of like, you know, professional handsets that you need. And on that basis, that could be a real growth driver for him, whereby people now can use low Earth orbit or geo satellite to do, you know, effectively lower latency, and you know they do all the amplifiers for the actual signals as well. So they've got a number of products that could do. I think that's in for free because the market is just looking at it and just thinking, oh well, until you show me some serious contracts, then I'm not going to give any up to it. But if they can make that work, that could be enormous. I mean, who knows? But I mean, you look at what low Earth satellites did for Filtronic.
Well, I was going to say, could it be the next Filtronic?
Well, I'd love to think so because I own it. But hey, there's a lot of bread to break on that one. That's before that. Okay, yeah. Good. We've got John. He's asking about Likewise, which is a carpet distributor, I think, in the UK. Do you own this or something? But anyway, they've been knocking the ball out of the park in terms of beating up their competitor Headlam, but I think they came out with a profit warning, which was sort of a bit of a block to the copybook.
Yeah, I can't find my notes on it. It must have been this week. I think it was on Tuesday, actually, wasn't it? Really annoying because the revenue side. This is the challenger flooring distributor, revenge company, if you like, set up by Tony Brewer, I think, who used to be the CEO of Headlam. He's now crushing Headlam, basically, with Likewise. And I think they'll drive Headlam out of business. I really do. It looks like it's going that way. Give it a couple of years and Headlam won't have any more properties to sell, probably. And then it's losing 40 million quid a year, Headlam is. Likewise is only marginally profitable. So it was really irritating, this profit warning, because they're growing sales and market share. That side of things is fine, but they just announced, you know, what is it now, mid-November, calendar year end, 6 or 7 weeks before the year end, they just say, oh, we under forecast a bunch of costs have overrun. Well, I mean, that's just so basic. I mean, surely. So it seems to me, just an own goal, seems to me they haven't got proper control over the budgeting process. And they, you know, all we ask companies to do is to just prudently set the targets and then beat them by a bit, you know, even if macro is tough. So I think maybe the finance department and Likewise could do with a kick up the proverbials give us prudent forecasts and beat them. It's not rocket science. So I was a bit annoyed about that, but I see that it dropped about 10 or 11%. So not a disaster by any means. To me, this is definitely not a structural, you know, the business is going wrong type of profit warning. It's just they set the forecast too ambitiously and they've missed by a bit. So, and of course, Headlam to fight their corner and try and regain market share, they're bound to be discounting, aren't they? They're bound to be. So Likewise, maybe have to trim their prices a bit to compete. I don't know. But I mean, Likewise is clearly winning the battle. And that's why I'm in this show. I'm not interested really in short-term earnings. As long as it's not loss-making, that's good enough for me. And you've also got a very nice balance sheet with Likewise. Got lots of freehold property, nice and financially strong. I think it'll win the war. And if it does, then my kind of looking 2 to 5 years out, I wouldn't be surprised to see this share up at £0.75 to £1 a share. Four times the current level, potentially. If it knocks out Headlam, you could be looking at more than that. So it's more a medium to long-term thing. Short-term, yeah, a bit of a bump in the road because of bad forecasting.
What? How do you view the margins? Because it's about just less than 3% operating margins, which is unusually low for you know, when you prefer companies with more pricing power and more sort of like, you know, some USPs or some sort of IPR. I'm just surprised. Where do you, obviously you're positive in terms of you think margins going forward are going to rise significantly.
Yeah, it's just, it's small at the moment. That's the thing. I mean, bear in mind, this was a startup about, you know, sort of 10 years ago or even less maybe. So it's great. It's growing more. So they've had to put the infrastructure in place for a much bigger business. They've had to put the sales teams in place. Apparently they poached all the best salesmen from Headlam. And it's then just a question of, you know, letting the growth builds, and they're building new distribution centers and things like that. So it's work in progress, but you've got the pathway there for a much, much bigger business. And of course, the real prize will come if and when Headlam collapses, because then you've just got the whole market wide open to them. So, yeah, I mean, that's the exciting bit. So it's not really a stock you can value on current earnings. You need to look, it's a growth company. You have to look through that, and it's open-ended growth, really. I think it's quite exciting, but, you know, don't expect big profits and dividends at this stage. You know, it's something to, I think, sit and accumulate and just be patient with.
I've got Martin Nicol. He's asking about Viarnet, and apparently Lord Lee has just increased his stake to over 4%. So have you touched base with Lord Lee at all about why?
I saw him last night, actually. He enjoyed an alcohol-free lager, and I enjoyed three alcohol lagers. But a lovely man. Everyone likes Lord Lee, and very generous with his wisdom and time and everything. I didn't actually ask him about Viarnet. I forgot. So I said to him, will you do another podcast with me? He said, yes, love to, anytime. Just give me a shout. So I did a terrific podcast with him when I was out in Malta quite recently. And he was raving about Goodwin, and then really raving about it, saying, you know, this is another something of the quality of Rolls-Royce, you know, going forward. And then two or three days later, that explosive rally happened. So everyone was saying, oh my God, I'm just going to buy whatever Lord Lee's buying. You know, the man's a genius. So I'll get him on again at some point in the next few months, and I'll ask him all about Viarnet. I don't rate it. I followed Viarnet for donkey's years, used to own shares in it, always promising better things in future, always disappointing. I don't think it's a very good business, actually. But look, it's come down a lot. It's roughly halved from a silly valuation not that long ago to a valuation now. I would say it's kind of all right. The cash flow statement wasn't too bad. I remember I looked at the last set of accounts. It's not a bad business, but the Brew Lines core business is in decline, slow, gradual decline, as the pub sector contracts. And they've been promising they're going to expand it into America for about 10 or 15 years, and they don't seem to get anywhere. And the vending business is subscale, so I don't rate it personally. But obviously Lord Lee, you know, vastly more successful than investor than me, he likes it, so I need to take my finger off the transmit button and click on receive and hear what he's got to say about it. Have you looked at Viarnet, Paul?
I have the same view as you. It's been around for ages, and it's never really got to a sufficient level to get sort of like 10% organic growth and all that kind of stuff. And telemetry, which is probably the, you know, the more attractive part of that business, is super competitive, and it has been for 15 years. I'm with you. It's a good recurring revenue stream, but unless they get something new where they're going to grow, they need to spend, and to me, they probably need to spend in R&D and try and get some unique view that gives them an edge in terms of winning these contracts. Because, I mean, yes, everything is going to, you know, smart everything, and therefore you think it's going to do well, but effectively it's very, very competitive, and I think that's where they struggle.
And it's old technology. This stuff is, I mean, I remember when I challenged the CFO, I think it's the same guy there, really prickly guy. And they were calling it an Internet of Things business. And I said to him, my readers are quite skeptical about this Internet of Things, that it's just basically devices that link into a Wi-Fi unit. You know, I said that technology has been around for 25 years. So how would you convince my readers that this is a sexy Internet of Things company? And he said, well, I just suggest that your readers buy a different company's shares then. I thought, what? He acted like he was chairman of ICI. It was unbelievable. This was the FD. So that really put me off. So, yeah.
Well, I remember you writing a research report about 15 years ago on this company, and I think the shares were about £1.10. Well, they've gone down, haven't they, since then? So it's gone nowhere. I'd love to think differently, but I'd love to hear what Lord Lee has got to say. What's the investment thesis behind it? What's going to change and move the dial? So we'll put that as...
I think he was probably just below 3%, so I don't think he bought, you know, the 4% in one hit. I suspect he was, or I heard, third hand or something. I think he was topping up. From the proceeds, didn't he have a big... Oh, no, he sold his big position in Treat, didn't he? That was, I think, where the money came from. But,
We've got one final question. We've got Andrew Woods asking about Future Group, which is the media business that also owns Go Compare. I know we've talked about this sector quite a lot. Very, very cheap, or the shares have fallen a lot. What's your sort of take on Future?
I haven't looked at it for a little while. This is the thing where they create all this. I suppose it boils down to the AI thing, which you've spoken about before on this. I mean, it's on an incredibly low PE, about 5, I think. Mm. Big buybacks, very cash generative. It's whether the AI stuff kills it, basically, or whether they can actually monetize their content. Now, interestingly enough, actually, when we were talking to Nigel at Bloomsbury, he was actually saying that he sees AI as an opportunity because he used the phrase, the big technology companies are beating a path to our door to license their content. And he said, even though the unit prices they achieve are quite small from AI, he was saying that they've got such a huge back catalogue of content that actually the money can be quite a significant amount. And he said overall he sees AI as more an opportunity for Bloomsbury Publishing than a threat. So I'm wondering if there's read across from that to Future. I mean, if there is, then Future shares could re-rate upwards quite nicely from the current low valuation. So, I mean, you know far more about this than me, than Paul. So can you answer that question?
Yeah, I think it's a value trap. With terms of AI, I mean, one of its biggest earning generators is Go Compare. And I think price comparison websites are going to get disintermediated by the likes of the new Atlas, sort of like the search engine or effectively discovery engine coming out of ChatGPT. And I think they're all going to be the same. They're going to give you one answer and it's going to tell you, you know, how to buy it, where to buy it and what the price is. And they'll sort it out because they'll make it personal to you. And then the other part of that, of their business, is they're publishing things like Marie Claire. And also they've got big tech publications that do sort of like the top 10 TVs to buy, and obviously they're sort of like advert based, where they get a clip where they get paid by putting volume through, and that's getting absolutely annihilated because it doesn't get traffic from Google now, or not as much as it used to, because effectively those 10 links, those 10 blue links now is just one number on you know, in Gemini for Google. So I would not go anywhere near this whole space myself. I don't own shares in it for exactly the same reason, but very cheap, 5x, but I think that E is coming down quite rapidly.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Paul. I mean, it's also, I think, a real reminder of just how fast business models change now because of technology and all sorts of other things. You know, it used to be the case that, you know, business models were pretty static, weren't they, really? But now, you know, I've seen Future, it would be this amazing growth company on a really high PE, compounding all the growth and hugely valuable. And then in just a few short years, it's just crashed, hasn't it, really, down to a value share on a PE of 5. So, yeah, it makes our jobs as investors so much more difficult, doesn't it, trying to work out, is this sector or this company vulnerable in any way? Yeah, and buying your low PE stocks, it can be quite dangerous, strangely enough, can't it?
Anyway, good. Okay, well, we've done 75 minutes. So thanks again, everyone, for your questions. Thanks very much, Paul, for your comments and the insights. Absolutely fascinating, as always. And same time, same place, same channel next week at 2 p.m. on Thursday. So thanks again, guys.
Excellent. Thanks, Paul. Thanks, everyone.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.